Blog Talk Radio.
Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing? I mean, nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Program, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grief process. You know, with roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, that's about a third of the population. That means that everyone probably knows someone caring for a loved one. They say that there's only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. I'm talking mothers of special needs and very young children, family members caring for elderly parents, spouses, siblings, or friends caring for disabilities such as Alzheimer's, dementia, cancer, stroke, heart disease, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, AIDS, autoimmune diseases, and a host of others. I can go on and on. Join Dave and his guests now and every Wednesday at noon Pacific time as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. So find a comfortable place to relax, kick up your feet, and prepare to feel better and to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to get you through today and every day so you can survive your tomorrows. But not just survive, but to live life fully and abundantly. Yes, you heard me right. That is a possible goal to achieve. And now, here's your host, Dave Nassani. Hey, from Los Angeles, a big LA welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I am Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally through the famous Worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network. Yes, folks, I'm the guy who's going to help you and guide you through this very difficult journey called caregiving. And we're going to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. Sounds nasty, doesn't it? Well, it is nasty. Now, we have an exciting show planned for you today, so stay tuned. Christopher Berry, certified elder law attorney, helping seniors, vets, and their families plan for long-term care. You do not want to miss this interview. As I said, I'm your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is to caregivers of every kind. And the one thing we know about caregivers is that they are, well, they're caring, they're selfless, they're sacrificial. Okay, I know that's three. But they're also very prone to burnout because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. Folks, come on, learn a lesson from the airlines. Remember, every time you board a plane, you tune them out because they start telling you stuff you don't want to hear, that if there's an emergency, to put your own oxygen mask on first before you help your child with their mask. And the reason they tell you that is because they know that you will most likely black out if you don't put your needs above the needs of your loved ones. And then you won't be of any help to anybody, gosh, with anything. And guess what? Caregivers are exactly the same way. We also talk about grief and loss here and the devastating effects that it can have on us. It automatically throws us into this, gosh, this other thing called the grief process. Ouch. Unfortunately, folks, there is only one way out of the grief process, and that's to go through the grief process. You can't go around it, can't go over it, can't go under it. You got to go through it. And hopefully we can help you through your grief and your loss if you happen to feel like you're stuck. Hey, if this is the first time tuning in, you can learn more about me and my show and my radio podcast, my books, my videos, my blog. I know. You're thinking, gosh, it's all about him. No, it's not all about me. It's actually all about you. So go to my website, caregiverscaregiver.com, and check it out. And look for that quiz that we have, and it's called Are You a Candidate for Burnout? And if you just take this short quiz, like six questions, we're going to send you a copy of my free book, One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships. And so that will be a very big help to you. Now, I'd like to take this moment and thank my last week's guest, Natasha Lee, self-care expert and founder of True Beauty Revealed and the Sacred Self-Care Retreat. All right, enough of that. I'm going to unmute my guest now. Chris Berry, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
There he is. I love it when the guests are where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be. So, Chris, thank you again for allowing me to interview you today. I really appreciate it. And why don't you begin by just telling us a little bit about yourself without getting into what I'm going to ask you later. Just really, who is Chris Berry?
Sure, Dave. Thanks. And thank you for the opportunity today. So I'm an estate planning and elder law attorney in Michigan, and I've dedicated my career to helping caregivers, seniors, families, and their loved ones navigate the long-term care maze. And from that, I wrote a book called The Caregiver's Legal Guide for Planning for a Loved One with Chronic Illness that has insider strategies to plan for Medicaid, veterans benefits, and long-term care, all that important information that caregivers need from a legal standpoint.
Sounds exciting. I usually don't like attorneys, but you sound like a very nice attorney.
You know, I mean, I like to say that we're the good guy attorneys. We're not doing divorces or criminal law or anything like that. We're just helping good families plan for long-term care.
So they haven't made any jokes about you, attorney jokes. Okay, that's good. You know, I'm also a caregiver, obviously, but I'm also in the gasoline business. And so I'm very closely linked to that other hated industry called the oil companies. So there's nobody more hated in society, I think, than oil companies, insurance companies, and, of course, attorneys. So, but you are one of the nice attorneys, so thank you for coming on the show. So let's get started here with these bad attorney jokes I'm making. How do you plan for my loved one, your loved one, my audience's loved one? Just how do you get started here? It seems like an overwhelming task.
Yeah, and often it is overwhelming, and that's where a lot of times a certified elder law attorney can really help direct that long-term care journey. It's something I like to call the elder care continuum, and there's a couple key legal tools and a couple key legal strategies that need to be utilized, but I understand every situation is a little bit different, so I'm happy to talk in generalities, and there's some things that everyone needs to know, but everyone's situation, as I'm sure you're aware, is just a little bit different.
Yeah. So you said certified. What does that mean exactly, a certified elder care attorney?
Well, Dave, any attorney can say they focus on elder care or elder law, but in reality, there's only one designation that your listeners should be looking for, and that's the designation called a certified elder law attorney. And what it is an American Bar Association accreditation where we, as an elder law attorney, we need to sit down and take an exam. And as an attorney, once you take a bar exam, you never want to take another exam in your life ever. and so to sit for this exam, you need to be peer-reviewed, show a certain level of experience and expertise in elder law. And then when you take the exam, it's only offered twice a year, and only 30% of the attorneys that sit down and take this exam actually pass it. And it's a six-hour exam just on elder law, where, in fact, they break elder law out into 12 different areas. So if you think elder law itself is a niche, well, think of breaking elder law into 12 different areas, including Social Security, housing, estate planning, Medicaid, veterans benefits. And this is a national designation, so every state will have a certain number of certified elder law attorneys, and it's been around since 1993, actually. In my state of Michigan, as we speak today, I think there are 17 of us, and maybe 400 across the whole nation. But just like when I take my car into the auto shop for work, I can't tell a good mechanic from a bad mechanic. But this designation, CELA, Certified Elder Law Attorney designation, is certainly a designation where if you have a loved one or if you're a caregiver and you're searching for elder law advice, you're going to want to search for a certified elder law attorney. And you can do so by going to the National Elder Law Foundation website, NELF.org, to find a certified elder law attorney in your area.
Now, were you an attorney before you got certified, or you did all this at the same time?
Nope, you have to be an attorney first, and then actually you have to be practicing exclusively in elder law for a period of 5 years before you're even able to sit down for the exam. So I was probably practicing for about 8 years before I felt like I had the level of knowledge necessary to sit down and pass the exam at my first time, which I was able to do.
And I hate to put you on the spot here, but did you pass your bar exam on the first attempt?
I did.
Oh, good. I was hoping you said that.
So, yeah.
when do I plan? I mean, how old do my parents have to be? You say we need to plan. When do we plan? When they're like got one foot in the grave, when they're still active and driving their cars and stuff? When do we get involved? When do we start saying, uh-oh, I better get a plan together?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the answer is really it's never too early to plan. Because once you turn 18, legally you're an adult, and you need to make certain designations with regards. You might not act, but legally you're an adult, so you need things like powers of attorney in place. But a lot of times when people are generally in their 40s or 50s, they'll start thinking about an estate plan. An estate plan is really planning for what happens if I were to pass away. But if you're caring for someone, generally when they start to need assistance is when people start to come into my office. So it might be when you're sitting around coming home for a family dinner and you're saying that mom and dad might not be as quick as they used to be, or they're forgetting some things here and there, or maybe when you're diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia. Because unfortunately, people don't want to come visit an estate planning or elder law attorney. But you never know when life's going to throw you a curveball. So it's important to start thinking about these things as soon as possible. Because the reason for that is the longer we wait, the more we're in a crisis mode, the less options we're going to have. And that's something that's important to understand. The earlier we start planning for long-term care or elder care needs, the more options we're going to have on the table, especially in terms of paying for long-term care costs. For example, something like long-term care insurance is something that you need to explore long before you think you might need it.
Right, right. Well, that's why I got mine when I was 45, and I've been making those payments, man. I'm 61 now, and I'm saying, come on, baby. A lot of people don't have long-term care, but mine pays about $400 a day, which is Malibu on the ocean, while I'm looking at the ocean, and I don't even know what I'm looking at. So, I would encourage people, because if you try to buy it now, you can't afford it, right?
Right, yeah. And long-term care insurance is one of the six ways to pay for long-term care that I talk about in my book. But it's great that you have it at your age. I myself have long-term care insurance. So there's different types of long-term care insurance now. And I find that a lot of my clients, when they're coming in, they certainly wish they had it. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, how do we pay for it? Is it very expensive? I mean, mine is affordable. I bought it, it's been 15 years ago maybe now, and it's about $110 a month. And to my amazement, it hasn't gone up, even though there's a little clause in my contract that says it could go up, but it'll go up for everybody. So I'm impressed so far.
Yeah, so long-term care insurance, it's not right for everybody, but it is a tool. It's not a magic wand. It's not going to make paying for long-term care go away or not a problem anymore. It's one of the tools for paying for long-term care. And in reality, there's really three types of long-term care insurance now. Mm-hmm. And probably what you have is a form of pure long-term care insurance, where, like you said, you pay for it every month or every year, and that buys you a certain level of benefits. You might have a daily limit on that benefit. You mentioned $400. You might have a lifetime cap on that benefit, or it could be unlimited. You might have an elimination period. So each long-term care insurance policy is different, and it can be tailored to whatever your level of need is and how much you want to insure against, because it is pure insurance in the sense that if you don't use it, you lose it. And that's led to the creation of a second type of long-term care insurance that we see a little more these days, and it's a form of hybrid policy where it's tied to a life insurance benefit. So just as an example, you might put in $100,000 into this product, and that could buy you a $300,000 long-term care insurance benefit and maybe a $150,000 death benefit, so that you know at the end of the day, kind of just like taxes, you can't get around those things. You're either going to become incapacitated and need that long-term care benefit, or you can get that death benefit at the end of the day. And then the third, just continuing that thought, the third type of long-term care insurance we see is long-term care riders that are hooked onto investment products, where it's more of an investment product that may double or triple the income if there's a need for long-term care. So those are the three types of long-term care insurance we see these days. in addition to that pure long-term care insurance that you mentioned and that I also have personally.
Yeah, so that second type typically has a cash value then, right? You can cash it out if for some crazy reason you decide you don't want it anymore?
Yeah, you're correct. There's really three ways to get your money back out of that type of product. You can either cash it out. Generally, you can get full amount you put in after a year or so, and that's where we mentioned insurance companies being one of the evils in the world and why people don't like them. But that's one of the ways that they make the money is they hold on to that the cash for a period of time. So the three ways is you can either just take your cash out, you can cash out on the death benefit, or you can get that long-term care benefit. So there's three buckets or three ways you can get your money out of those products. But what appeals to people about that is that you're going to trigger one of those three. So at the end of the day, you're going to get your money back.
Now, you're sounding very much like an insurance agent right now, but you're not an insurance agent. You're not selling this, right? You send us to somebody who does, or how's that work?
Correct. I'm a certified elder law attorney. I don't sell this. It's my job to know what's out there. So I review a lot of long-term care contracts. Mm-hmm. And where it fits into what I advise is that it's one of six ways to pay for long-term care, along with things like veterans benefits and Medicaid. So clients come to me, and you mentioned with your long-term care insurance how there's some language in there that says that they can raise the rates on you.
Right.
Well, in the state that I practiced a couple of years ago, they raised the rates 1 year 40% on most people that had long-term care insurance in place. And when you're a senior on relatively fixed budget, to have a 40% increase on something, to use a legal term, that kind of sucks. But the following year, on some policies that my clients had, they actually raised it 80%. So a lot of clients were coming to me as an attorney to say, hey, we can't pay for these long-term care insurance benefits anymore. What other ways can we look at paying for long-term care? And that's really where I come in. So, no, I'm not an insurance salesman. I'm not saying that long-term care insurance is a magic wand at all. I just want people to understand it's a tool to be used.
Yeah. Is it unusual that mine has not gone up after so many years?
No, it's not unusual. It really depends on your state and what type of insurance company that you bought your product from. Some of the long-term care insurance companies have basically stopped offering long-term care insurance entirely because
not profitable.
They kind of guessed wrong or figured wrong in terms of how many people would actually use it, how many people would keep their policy intact, and how much they would have to pay out. So what happened in my state is that the insurance companies had to petition the state to be able to do this increase, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to pay out on any of these policies. And so they gave people the opportunity to either keep their current level of benefits and increase the premium, or decrease the benefits and keep the same premium. So that's one of the big problems I see with long-term care insurance, along with the fact that people just don't understand the policies they have. And I mentioned all the variables of premium, elimination period, daily caps. For example, if your long-term care insurance benefits only capping out at $50 a day, well, when you're looking at nursing home level care, that's just a drop in the bucket. So I'm not pro or con against long-term care insurance. I just look at it as a tool. And if someone has a need or says that they want it, a lot of times I'll refer it to a long-term care insurance specialist who will focus on just that piece.
Yeah, State Farm is who I bought it from, so hopefully they're a good company.
Sure.
A lot of people that I speak with say, oh, no, I'm just going to do the Medi-Cal or Medicaid thing. And, of course, I always thought that you had to be destitute. And what a lot of people do is they take the assets out of their parents' name, because there aren't that many anyway, and all they have really is their Social Security check, and boom, they qualify for Medicaid. But my mother-in-law just qualified for Medicaid because they eased the regulations. Now you can own one house, one car. Is this true? Are they just kind of making it easier and easier to get on Medicaid?
Well, what I found is that they're actually making it more and more difficult to qualify for Medicaid or Medi-Cal, depending on your state. Now, each state's a little bit different. But for example, in my state, you're allowed to have, as a single individual, $2,000 worth of countable assets.
Mm-hmm.
And countable assets are basically everything except for a home, automobile, personal possessions, and small cash value of life insurance.
Right.
So really, they don't allow you to keep much. And that's pretty consistent state by state, because Medicaid is a joint federal and state program, where at the federal level, they develop the rules or guidelines, and then each state then interprets those guidelines to come up with their own laws. And then the state of California decided to, instead of calling it Medicaid, they decided to call it Medi-Cal.
That makes sense, because we have a very, very, very liberal state here. It just depends on whether your state is liberal or conservative as to the rules. And, you know, California just likes to give the store away to anybody who comes into the country legally or illegally. So, but we won't go into that, will we? Unless your name is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly. Yeah. But one thing I found is that they are, in most states, they are making it more difficult to qualify for Medicaid when you're setting foot in a nursing home. For example, in my state last year, from a legal perspective, they kind of closed one of the routes we had to get a married couple qualified for Medicaid. So they're making it more difficult, I found, across the nation. Now, California might be a little different, but most states I found, they're making it more difficult each and every year.
Now, California is different because Medicaid typically does not pay for assisted living, right? It only pays for nursing homes for 100 days or something like that.
There's a difference between Medicare and Medicaid. And
Medicaid
Medicaid or Medi-Cal is really only going to pay for nursing home level care. And then occasionally there's some Medicaid programs that will help pay for home care. In my state, to get on that home care Medicaid, which is called the Michigan Choice Waiver Program, there's basically a two-year wait to get onto that program. So there's not enough dollars to really be able to utilize that program. So in my state, we really only have Medicaid to pay for, or Medicaid will only pay for nursing home level care. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is that there's a whole continuum of care, starting with care in the home, whether it's provided by a home care or provided by a caregiver or commercial home care company, assisted living with memory care, and then nursing home level care. And it's unfortunate that this money, or a majority of the money earmarked for long-term care, only pays for nursing home care, but it doesn't help with assisted living or home care.
Right.
And that's really where most people would want to be if they could be. They want to be in the least restricted type of care possible.
Well, then they should all move to California, because they have something here for the last 5 years, and they just renewed it. It's called the Assisted Living Waiver Program. And Medicaid will actually pay 100% of your assisted living, because they're doing that with my mother until she just passed away recently. And now they're about to do it for my mother-in-law. So that's a great deal, because, you know, they're charging $3,000 or $4,000 a month, and they take the Medicare check, and then they pay the difference to the assisted living. Now, they do negotiate a reduced rate, but they're still paying a lot of money. So it sounds like California might be one of the most generous states in the nation if you're an elder. Would you agree?
Yeah, that sounds like a great program. I wish there was more ways to pay for home care or assisted living.
Yeah.
One of the things that we do in a lot of the other states is rely on the veterans benefit, if possible, to help pay for home care or assisted living.
Yeah. And even if you're a spouse of a veteran, there's possibility that you can get veteran benefits?
Yeah, of course. So the five requirements to qualify for the VA benefit are 90 days active duty, 1 day during a period of war, cannot be dishonorably discharged, and then more long-term care costs and income. Then there's an asset test. But it also works for a surviving spouse as well. So if the veteran, or if the spouse was married to the veteran when the veteran passed away and the spouse is not remarried, and they meet those first three requirements of 90 days active duty, 1 day during a period of war, cannot be dishonorably discharged, then that surviving spouse can qualify for a benefit of just over $1,000 a month to help pay for home care or assisted living. And that benefit could be paid to a caregiver, a family caregiver as well. So a son or daughter could be taking care of mom as a surviving spouse. They could then qualify for that surviving spousal VA benefit.
Yeah. Has the cost of health care stayed the same? I mean, like I said, to insure a 45-year-old right now for, let's say, you know, $400, 1 million max, is it kind of going to be roughly in the $100 to $125 range, or have rates really gone up and I'm kind of grandfathered in?
Well, I can't really speak to the premiums on long-term care insurance because I don't sell long-term care insurance.
Mm-hmm.
What I can speak to is the cost of long-term care, which where I'm at, that certainly went up, gone up every year. For example, most states have, as part of their Medicaid program, they have the average cost of nursing home care across the whole state, and it goes up every year. And I think that's a function of the cost of medicine, the cost of health care, and then also keep in mind our longevity. We're living longer than ever, and a lot of times our body is kept alive or kept healthier, but sometimes it's our mind that's going. So we're seeing a lot more issues with memory care, dementia, Alzheimer's than ever before.
Yeah, you know, you're so right about anything to do with medical, pharmaceutical, hospital, long-term care facilities, nursing homes are going up dramatically. And I'm wondering why that doesn't show up in the economy's inflation rate, because typically, you know, there's probably a 50% inflation rate in the medical industry, and yet they say inflation is non-existent in the economy. Does that mean all the other industries are in deflation and just kind of balancing out? I know you're not an economist, but that just things like that concern me.
it's certainly one of those kind of booming areas of in terms of the economy where it seems like well, even now, I see home care companies popping up left and right, assisted living being built all over the place. So I think it's the growing baby boomers starting to age, but I don't know why the costs are also increasing so much as well.
Well, gosh, there's so much to talk about. We're going to take a break, and then we'll get more into how to protect our assets. So don't go away. We'll be right back. One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships. Available on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. Hear what Lynn Barrington, best-selling author of Daddies and Daughters, published by Simon & Schuster, has to say about it. You think you have it bad? Read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story told from the heart. It's inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light. How about the reaction of 9-time Grammy and Dove Award winner, the godfather of contemporary gospel music, Andre Crouch? This book will be an encouragement to anyone who reads it. Charlene just won't let the promises of God go. She's hanging on to her positive, godly attitude, and I look forward to that day when she will receive all that she's believing that God will do for her. In the meantime, she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. Her smile has gotten just as big as it was before her stroke. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror, as the Bible states. And I'm glad to know her and her testimony. Read this book. You'll be encouraged regardless of what you're going through. So get your copy of One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships today on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. But if you purchase it on the author's website, Dave and Charlene Nassani will personally autograph your copy. Just go to OneArmOneLeg100Words.com. That's OneArmOneLeg100Words.com. Oh, and while you're on his website, don't forget to take our short quiz to help you assess if you are a candidate for burnout, and if so, where you are in the burnout process. And just for doing that, Dave will send you a special gift. There are a lot of resources, videos, and links to his radio podcast on his website. Go to caregiverscaregiver.com. That's caregiverscaregiver.com. And now, let's rejoin Dave Nassani and his guest on Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver program on the Worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network. And we're back with Chris Berry, Certified Elder Law Attorney. So, Chris, let me ask you, how do we protect our assets?
Great question, Dave. Really, there's 6 ways to pay for long-term care. And once we understand that, we can look at ways to protect our assets from long-term care. So those 6 ways, first, we start with private pay, meaning we can just pay out of our own funds. So we look to see how much money we have, and we spend that down until we run out of money. The second way is that we can have the kids pay. Now, a lot of times the kids don't pay financially, but they often pay in terms of their time, serving as a caregiver, taking time out of their day to visit the elder law attorney. Many of my clients have had to put their life on hold to be a full-time caregiver for mom or dad. So understand that the kids do pay even if they don't pay financially, because everything in life is either time or money, it seems like. Third, Medicare. So Medicare pays for short-term rehab typically. Medicare typically pays for hospice. But Medicare typically does not pay for long-term care. The way Medicare typically works is that if you have some type of acute incident, for example, mom falls, breaks her hip, hospitalized for 3 days, and then discharged to rehab, Medicare, along with supplemental insurance, will generally pay up to 100 days. But typically, it doesn't pay for long-term care. Fourth, we have long-term care insurance. And we talked about that a little bit in terms of the different types of long-term care insurance. By no means is it a magic wand or a miracle, but it is one of the tools or one of the ways we can pay for long-term care. Fifth, we have the VA benefit that can help either veterans or surviving spouses pay for just over $2,000 a month in long-term care. Typically, we use this for home care or assisted living. And the final way to pay for long-term care is to look at the Medicaid or Medi-Cal program, which typically pays for nursing home level care, occasionally home care or assisted living. So understanding that we only have six ways to pay for long-term care, then it's just a matter of planning and planning ahead, utilizing things like long-term care insurance. And then as an attorney, this is often where I'll come in, we have both planning and crisis legal strategies to help pay for long-term care. So there's some things we can do when we're planning ahead in terms of special types of asset protection trusts that we can utilize. And then also we have crisis strategies where if you have a loved one who needs long-term care now, whether it's home care, or assisted living, or nursing home level care typically, there's some legal strategies we can do to protect those assets. For example, if you have a loved one who needs nursing home care now, which where I'm at can run over $10,000 a month, there's some things we can do whether they're single or widowed or married. For example, a married couple in my state right now, generally we can protect 100% of their assets and get them immediately qualified for Medicaid without having to spend down all of their assets or engage in that nursing home or Medicaid spend down. And a good example of this was some clients I had that came into my office, Bill and Ethel. Those aren't their real names, of course, but Bill, attorney-client privilege and everything. So yeah. Bill was 70, had Alzheimer's, and Ethel was his caregiver for a number of years. At this point, she's 62. She was a retired school teacher. She had been a caregiver for him for a number of years to the point that she couldn't care for him anymore. And medically, he needed nursing home level care. Mm-hmm. And she was in my office crying because she found an appropriate nursing home for him that was near her where she'd be able to visit regularly. Mm-hmm. But it was going to run just over $10,000 a month.
Wow.
And she was like a number of my clients, not a millionaire, but just average retired school teacher. He worked for the auto industry. They had their home. They had small Social Security and pension and had about $300,000 of their nest egg saved up. They spent a lot of their money putting their two kids through school who are now living in different states. One was living in California, I think working in the film industry, actually. She was very proud of her. And then the other one was in New York. She was the sole caregiver for a number of years, and so she couldn't do it anymore. But she was in my office crying because she didn't know how she was going to pay for his care at $10,000 a month. What is she going to do when she ran out of money? And then the second issue was that she was completely healthy. She was a healthy 62-year-old with a long life ahead of her. And the second issue was what was going to happen to her.
Right.
Would she be completely impoverished because of the random luck that her husband got diagnosed with Alzheimer's? Because in this country, if you have a heart attack, we have insurance that's going to cover that. But if you get diagnosed with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or some type of other chronic illness, we don't really have a good framework to take care of that. And so in that situation, we were able to use a special type of trust in our state where we were able to move that $300,000 into a trust for her benefit. She had direct access to it, and then immediately get her husband qualified for Medicaid so that he would pay the nursing home his income, but she was still entitled to her income, her Social Security, her pension, and then she had this $300,000 that she could use to either pay for additional services for him or just have a peace of mind to know that she's not going to go completely broke because randomly her husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Good call. How can we protect our homes? Was the home included in your list of assets that you mentioned in the last segment there?
Yes. In most states, in many states, the home is an exempt asset during your lifetime or during the person who needs care during his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But many states, in fact, I think all states now, have some form of a state recovery, meaning they can actually, or the state can actually place a lien on the home to recover whatever the state paid out in long-term care or Medicaid benefits. For example, let's say that the state pays out $50,000 of benefit and the home is valued at $150,000. Well, when that person who needs care, who needed Medicaid, passes away, the state can place a lien on that home for $50,000 that needs to be paid off and the home is sold. Now, there's different strategies depending upon which state to protect the home. For example, in my state, there's two ways that we can protect the home. The first way is from a planning standpoint. If we're planning ahead, we can put that home into a form of asset protection trust, which is different than your typical revocable living trust.
Really?
Typically, these asset protection trusts are set up to start the five-year clock ticking because Medicaid has a five-year look-back period, meaning they're going to look back 5 years to see if you've moved any assets around.
And similar to bankruptcy,
your house into
I guess,
one of these types
right?
Yeah, it is similar to bankruptcy. So if you can make it 5 years, then the home is protected. And then in my state, we have estate recovery, but we don't have enhanced estate recovery. And what that means is we can do a form of deed called, we call it a legacy deed, but you might hear it called a ladybird deed, where it avoids probate and also avoids estate recovery. So we use those in crisis situations where we have a loved one in a nursing home now, or a loved one who's not going to go or who may go into the nursing home in the near future. So generally, there are strategies to protect the home, but it's going to be state-specific, so it's going to be important to talk to a certified elder law attorney.
Wow. A lot of stuff to know. That's why you need a certified elder care attorney. Can't do this by yourself, can you?
Well, and there's a lot of misinformation out there, too, where you'll hear that your neighbor did this, or the person at the salon did that, or there's even attorneys who don't really specialize in this area of law. They should get it wrong. So generally, when you're working with a certified elder law attorney, this is all that they're going to do, because you need to have a deep level of knowledge in this area. You can't be doing criminal law on Monday, divorce on Tuesday, and then become an elder law attorney on Wednesday, because we're looking at probates, taxes, legal, healthcare issues, it all fits together in a holistic solution for each family.
Yeah, you can't be a jack of all trades and master of none, right? Now, I noticed you did not mention reverse mortgages. Are you a proponent of them?
Well, I think it's a tool, but it's definitely a tool that was overused in the past, and now there's been a lot of regulations placed on reverse mortgages. So it is a way to pay for long-term care, but in my practice, I don't see it used very often because at the end of the day, the home gets lost. But it is a tool. I'm not against it. I'm not for it. What I would stress is that you're educated on the process and the results of that reverse mortgage. And I feel it's really no different than long-term care insurance. As long as you're educated on the process and the results, educated on the tool, then I don't have a problem with it. I think it's a tool. My only problem with that is that in the past it was overused by sales. So As long as you're educated on what you're walking into, then I'm not for it or against it.
Well, I thought all the regulations they added to it made it better for the homeowner, because before you lost it no matter what, and now at least you know you can always get it back if there's equity in it, and you could get the equity. And so, is it a good thing, all those regulations, or is it a bad thing?
Well, without getting political, typically I'm for less regulation, but in respect to the changes that we've had with reverse mortgages, I definitely think it's definitely more advantageous to the individual who's looking at getting a reverse mortgage.
Okay. Now, can we give money away if we have too much of it? And who do we give it to?
So I guess I'm very much against the idea of just giving money away, because when you give that money away, if something goes wrong, are they going to give the money back? Because typically, well, with Medicaid, we have this 5-year look-back period, and then with veterans benefits, they're talking about this 3-year look-back period. So I hear a lot of families are talk about giving money away, but I find that problematic, because let's say you give away $50,000 or $100,000 in 1 year, or I had a client who gave money to the grandchildren to help pay for college, then all of a sudden had a stroke and now was penalized because they gave money away. I find that problematic. And then also, if you were to give that money to, say, a son or daughter, and then they get divorced, well, guess what? You could be losing your money. So I don't generally recommend giving money away. If we're looking at moving money out of someone's name, generally I look at using an asset protection trust, because with the trust, there's control. So the person who's setting up the trust, who's trying to protect those assets, can actually control the assets inside of the trust. Also, it's protected against things like divorce or creditor actions or bankruptcies. For example, if you were to give that money away to a son or daughter and they get in a car accident, they're sued, and then now there's a creditor, they could lose mom or dad's money. So I don't like the idea of giving money outright to people, no strings attached. If that's going to be part of a strategy, I would look to moving that money into a trust.
Well, let's talk about trusts. What is the difference between an asset protection trust and a revocable living trust like I have that my attorney set up for me?
Well, understand that every trust is going to be different depending upon the attorney that drafts it. Not all living trusts are created equal, nor are all estate or asset protection trusts created equal. But typically, when I'm referring to an asset protection trust, it works differently than your typical revocable living trust. So with your typical revocable living trust, there's a couple roles or responsibilities. And I myself have a living trust at my age. And the first role or responsibility is that of a trust maker. So who's the person that created the trust? So Dave, in your situation, you're the person that created the trust. You're the trust maker. The second role or responsibility is that of a trustee. So with your typical revocable living trust, you also serve as trustee while you're alive and well. The job of the trustee is to hold on to the assets. So think of that kind of trust kind of like a suitcase or purse. While you're alive and well, you're the person that created the trust. You're the trust maker. You're the trustee. You're the one holding on to the suitcase. And then also the third role or responsibility is that of a beneficiary. So initially, while you're alive and well, Dave, you're the beneficiary of your own trust, meaning you're holding the assets for your own benefit. So you can put assets in. You can take assets out of the trust. Then if you were to become incapacitated or pass away, you pass that suitcase on to your successor trustee, who then administers it for the benefit of the beneficiaries. For example, in my situation, I have 2 young children, ages 3 and 5. If I were to pass away, I don't want them getting all my life insurance outright, because they'd spend all the money on Legos, which I think would be cool, but not the best use of the money. So I've appointed a trustee to hold that money for their benefit. So the great thing about a revocable living trust is that you can make changes to it at any time. So if my kids fail to eat their broccoli at dinner time, I can threaten to take them out of the trust. Now, if you have better parenting tips to make them eat their broccoli, I'm searching for those.
That sounds pretty good to
me. Yeah. So now you compare that to an asset protection trust. The difference between an asset protection trust and a revocable trust, the biggest difference is that an asset protection trust is going to be irrevocable. And what that means is that once you set it up, you can't really make changes to it. So you're limited to how you can change your beneficiary. So I'd be limited in threatening my children to take them out of the trust.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you have to generally give up a certain level of access to the trust assets. So think of this type of trust more like a piggy bank than a suitcase that you can put things in, take things out. The idea is that you move these assets into the trust and that you're not going to directly take the assets out of the trust. Now, that said, you can receive all the income that gets generated on the trust. So let's say we put $100,000 in the home into an asset protection trust. Let's say that $100,000 goes up $10,000 over the year. Well, you can receive the benefit of that $10,000. But if you wanted to access that $100,000, generally there's a step or two that you would have to do to be able to get access to that. Mm-hmm. And that's really the trade-off between an asset protection trust and your revocable living trust. So
yeah,
think of your revocable living trust as kind of a suitcase and your asset protection trust is more of a piggy bank.
So there is a disadvantage in having less control. So what are the benefits of giving up that control? Is it taxes?
Sure. So the benefits are, and this is depending on how the trust is drafted, you could have some creditor protection.
I see.
The big thing is we use this for long-term care protection. So if you are trying to get qualified for the VA benefit that has an asset limit, asset test, well, if we were to move the excess assets into this asset protection trust,
mm-hmm.
you could then get qualified for the VA benefit. Or if you were concerned about long-term care costs in the future, for example, maybe you're recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia
right.
or Parkinson's,
mm-hmm.
you can move these assets into the trust and ensure that if push comes to shove and all of a sudden you need long-term care, you wouldn't have to go broke paying for long-term care because whatever you had in that piggy bank would be protected. And it could be accessed by you and the family in the future if you needed to.
So
it's
this
a way
is,
that we can protect those assets from long-term care costs.
So this is a way of giving money away but doing it smarter. You're putting it in a trust where you've lost control over it until you die, then control comes back to... not in case you die. In case you have to be put into a facility, then you have control back over it. Is that how it works?
Well, I wouldn't say that you lose control because you can control how the assets are invested. You can buy and sell.
Okay.
For example, you can put your primary residence into this trust and you could sell your house and put your new house into the trust. Really, the only loss of control you have is that if you wanted to, let's say, we put in $100,000, now you want to take out $50,000 to go on a cruise around the world, there's a couple steps we'd have to do to get the money back to you. But understand, all the money could come back to you while you're alive and well. So it's a little bit of a shell game where you have to move some assets around, but in reality, you have full access to the income, you have limited access to the principal, and the benefit is that you don't have to worry about going broke because of long-term care costs.
This sounds like a good vehicle.
At the end of the day, if you pass away, the assets can go to whoever you want.
Yeah. This sounds like a good vehicle if you have too much income that you want to protect. And I remember hearing something about this, and I forgot about it. But, yeah, we need to talk more. Listen, time is wasting away from us here. We got to get moving because we're almost out of our hour together. Should I name family joint on accounts?
So that's probably one of the worst things that you can do. I don't use a lot of generalities, but I almost always advise that the only person that should be named jointly on an account is a husband and wife. You should almost never name children or anyone else jointly on any accounts. There's always a better way to do that. So the ways we typically see this is on things like real estate and bank accounts. Well, there's always a better way to do it. With real estate, it might be doing something called a legacy deed or Lady Bird deed. So it's in your name until you pass away. And then when you pass away, it goes to whoever you named on that deed. It's kind of like a beneficiary designation for your home. It avoids probate, avoids estate recovery. So don't name anyone jointly on real estate, because what happens if the person you named jointly gets divorced, goes through a lawsuit, bankruptcy, you could all of a sudden lose your home. Then with bank accounts, we see a mom naming son or daughter on an account joint so that they can write checks and it avoids probate. Well, again, if that son or daughter goes through some type of creditor action, that account, that asset could be gone. A better way to do that would be through transfer on death or payable on death designations at the bank. So if mom passes away, it goes to whoever was named. And then also having a well-drafted financial power of attorney document that's effective immediately. So with the immediate financial power of attorney document, if mom or dad decides not to pay bills today, all of a sudden son or daughter is able to step up without having to go to court or anything. So There's always a better way than joint ownership. Joint ownership should only be used for husband and wife.
Got it. And can I pay a family member for care? Is that allowable?
Yes and no. You can certainly pay a family member for care, and in many cases we actually recommend it as a way to qualify for the VA benefit. However, what's important to understand is that with Medicaid or Medi-Cal, you could be putting that person who needs care in a potentially dangerous situation, especially if you don't have a personal care contract. So it's important to have a personal care contract. Because otherwise, what a lot of times that state agency, they're going to say that that money that you paid for care was really a gift, unless there's some type of signed personal care contract in place. And if they say that money is a gift, all of a sudden you might be facing an investment penalty or might not be able to qualify for Medicaid or Medi-Cal, even though you don't have any assets left.
Right. It's like lending money to a relative. Make sure you have a contract, repayment plan, interest rate, et cetera, or it'll be called a gift.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Well, Chris, you're very, very knowledgeable, and I feel like we just touched the tip of the iceberg here. How can viewers get in touch with you if they want more information?
Sure, Dave. Thanks. Probably the best way is to visit our website, and the website is theeldercarefirm.com. That's theeldercarefirm.com, where we have a variety of resources and information available to them.
Cool. Well, I can't believe this hour has gone so fast. Thank you again, Chris, for allowing me to interview you, and thanking my listening audience for tuning in today and every Wednesday at noon live. And don't forget that all of our shows are recorded podcasts so that you can listen on the same link any time of the day or night, 24/7. They're also on our website, caregiverscaregiver.com. That's caregiverscaregiver.com. And it's on iTunes as well from my website's radio show tab. So just a reminder, when you are on my site, please don't forget to take the quiz, Are You a Candidate for Burnout?, so that you can assess where you are in the burnout process. Get your free copy of my book, One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships. So until next week, may God richly bless you. Goodbye. Thank you for joining Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show. Make sure you tune in every Wednesday at noon Pacific Time and anytime afterwards on podcast to catch more of Dave and his tips to caregivers on avoiding burnout and surviving the grief process right here on the Worldwide Block Talk Radio Network. Goodbye.